Doug Traversa is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tallahoma. He holds a degree in theology from Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago. Doug is a retired Air Force officer, and he and his wife, Jancy, live in Tallahoma. We welcome Doug to UUFM each month. Today, Doug will speak on the topic, What Now? How should we live for the rest of our lives? Doug.
I will begin by sharing a little bit with you that it has been an incredibly stressful approximately 6 weeks. My wife's parents have moved here to Tallahoma because her mother has been finally diagnosed with dementia. And after a series of pretty awful events out in Las Vegas where they lived, we finally got them to move here. We've been trying to do this for a couple of years. We've been trying to get her to go see a doctor for a couple of years. And finally, all those pieces have fallen into place, but it's been a long journey getting there. And then on top of all that stress, one of my dogs, and if you know me, you know my dogs are my family, had surgery Friday. And I don't know if you know this about dogs, they don't get kidney stones, they get bladder stones. And my little Pomeranian, who's about 8 pounds, came out with a handful, some marble-sized stones that were in her bladder. And it's pretty amazing. We didn't think her bladder was big enough to hold all those stones, never mind everything else bladders hold. The surgery went well, but it knocked her out so badly that yesterday she wouldn't hold any water down or food, and I'm starting to stress, and so last night I didn't sleep well, and I woke up at 4:30, and it's like, by the time my wife woke up, it's just, I'm just doing this. Head's in my hand, I'm thinking, I can't handle it anymore, and then I get to go give a sermon. Won't those folks in Murfreesboro be lucky to have me today? Fortunately, I'm happy to report I was finally able, through an eyedropper, to get my dog to drink water and not throw up. So she's looking a little better, and I at least have enough peace of mind to get through the next few hours and then rush back home and see if I can't get her to eat some food and finally take her pills she's supposed to be taking and move on from there. So now you know what, where I am, if I doze off in the middle of the sermon or during our discussion or something, you know, that's the alibi in advance. When I created this sermon last week, I'd actually written the whole thing, was actually doing the final read-through, and as I often do when I'm supposed to be working, I start browsing the internet because who wants to actually work? And I came across a quote. It's from a movie called The Peaceful Warrior. I've never seen the movie, knew nothing about it, but the quote fits in perfectly with the sermon, so I'm going to lead off with that. Everyone wants to tell you what to do and what's good for you. They don't want you to find your own answers. They want you to believe theirs. Now, this sermon is my final sermon both here and back at Tullahoma in my final month of my fifth year of being both lay minister slash minister. Now, I said that last week, and some new member rushed up afterwards and said, oh, are you leaving? No, it's just the end of my fifth year. I like to mark these little transitional points in my life. So it is the marks the 5 years. 5 years of seminary, sermon writing, sermon delivering, pondering the meaning of it all. And I'm happy to announce today, and some of you saw this on Facebook, I finally got the answer. The answer to life, the universe, and everything. But I really should not lead off with that, but it's good to know there's some Douglas Adams fans out there. But no, it's not actually 42. That was the wrong answer because the earth is so messed up that the question was wrong. But anyway, you're going to get Doug's answer. And it is Doug's answer. I'm going to preface everything with, it's Doug's answer. It doesn't have to be your answer, but it might give you some good ideas. It might give you something to think about. But before I give you that final answer, because I have to build a little suspense and anticipation, I'm going to tell you some stories instead. The first story is about a comic I found, again, because I was looking at Facebook instead of working, and it shows Charlton Heston in his most famous role as Moses with the Ten Commandments. And on one it says, be cool. And on the other, it says, don't be a jerk, except it uses a slightly more profane word than jerk, which I'm not going to use in church. But that was the new modified revised commandments. Be cool, don't be a jerk. Now, it's very tempting to say at this point, well, there you go, sermon over. My work here is done. Now I can go home and take a good look at my poor dog again. But no, there's more to it than that. 1 year ago, I began practicing Zazen, seated meditation in the Zen tradition. You do this facing a blank wall, and you try to clear your mind of all thoughts, and you try to do this without any goal in mind. And I actually shared with you about this a few months ago in one of my sermons. There's no chanting, there's no praying, there's no breathing exercise, there's no counting, and there's no thinking on koans, those infamous Buddhist riddles, such as, what is the sound of one hand clapping? No, instead, you're simply seated, trying to do nothing, trying to think nothing, and trying to have no expectations. You just sit. You take a leap of faith that there's a good reason to do this, even though you're not supposed to actually be striving for anything. There's not supposed to be a goal. You're just doing it because some other people who've done it have said it's a good thing to do. I mean, that really is the bottom line of why people do it, because other people have said, try this. But don't have any goals in mind when you try this. And that's really hard to do, because most of the time when we do something, anything, we do have a desired end result. We do have a goal. And so I did this for 9 months. I sat and I stared at a blank wall, and I tried not to have a desired outcome, and I didn't. And after 9 months of it, I decided I would stop. Now, why did I do this? And again, this is just Doug's. It's Doug's view on how things work for Doug, because I know lots of people meditate and derive great benefit from it, and I'm not downplaying that whatsoever. I'm just sharing this whole process of what next? What do we do? What do I do? What do you do with the rest of your life? So before I give you the answer to that question, because I'm going to keep giving you all these wonderful little why this, why that, and not telling you anything just yet, I want to take a look at what's going on around us. Everywhere we turn, people, corporations, advertisements, and of course religions are telling us how to live or what to do next. If you ask the question, what now? There are a million eager advisors out there who want to step in and tell you exactly what you should do next. There was a commercial running during the Christmas season that shows people coming out of a gigantic department store, and they're all nicely dressed, obviously affluent, and they're stopping by one of those Salvation Army type donation baskets, except it's Santa Claus and an elf. And as they're about to put some money in, they look up, and driving past is a Lexus. And they're stunned and in awe of this magnificent vehicle, and so they reach in and pull out the keys to their current car and throw those into the bucket instead, because they're going to rush off and buy a Lexus. Now, this is usually being shown during football season, and most of us who watch football probably aren't in the mood to then throw our keys away and go off and buy a Lexus. But they apparently thought that was a good advertising strategy. Now, as ludicrous as this may sound, throw away your car keys and go buy a Lexus on a whim because it's Christmas, because it drove by the street, and you just went, wow, I have to have that vehicle because my vehicle doesn't sufficiently get me from point A to point B. But a Lexus, now life's worth living. There are all sorts of things, people and groups that are doing essentially the same thing. They may not be selling you cars, but they're selling you eternal life, or a connection to God, or enlightenment, or some other spiritual aspect to your life. You may not be throwing your keys away, but you are asked to throw away something more precious, your time. For the last 5 years, I've read a great many books on religious thought, ethical living, the existence or non-existence of God. I've had many discussions with people who ponder these things. And during these 5 years, I have encountered numerous people who advocate for a certain path, a particular way of living or believing, that not only do they find very meaningful, but they really think it should apply to all other people. Or at least it should if they want to live the best way possible. And I have, to a lesser degree, also seen it done in matters of diet, political views, and social activism. At seminary, as broad-minded as Unitarian Universalists like to claim to be, there are some points of view that, while not exactly forbidden, are still on the other line of acceptable. Twice I made the mistake of telling my professors I did not think much of one of the readings we had to do. Once I was told that I was being resistant to the class. The other time I was told I would have to take a literary criticism class to graduate because I did not understand how to interpret literature properly. Now, after I pointed out that I was an English major and had indeed taken literary criticism, I still didn't like the book, didn't think it applied to the course, and after we had a long discussion about why I thought that, which actually entailed two long-distance phone calls to two different professors, we finally agreed that I did not have to take literary criticism to graduate. But I also learned a valuable lesson. There are lines everywhere you don't cross, and as much as we say we value free thought, sometimes we don't. Just stand up in a UU church and say, I'm a Republican. And I have Republicans at my church. Maybe there's some here, I don't know, but we do love to bash Republicans. I've heard it time and again. I had one speaker who started doing the us and they thing, and I had to go up to her afterwards and say, no, it's not us and they. We have Republicans here, and they're welcome here. Different thoughts are welcome here. Please don't make this adversarial. And sometimes we do that as you use. It's unfortunate, and we shouldn't do it. Having spent many years as a conservative Christian, I know what it's like to tell others the one true way, because I did it many, many, many times. We love to tell people what God's plan is for their life, that if they don't believe the right thing or do the right thing, not only is their life going to be unfulfilled, but they will receive eternal condemnation and literally burn forever in hell. At least that's what I believed. I had absolute knowledge that I was right and others were wrong. And I could condemn people that I knew next to nothing about as soon as they told me they didn't believe the same way. Now, I'm truly, truly embarrassed that I believed this for as many years as I did. But it is a part of my life, and it perhaps has helped me to now be on the other side of that with a force that many people aren't, with a knowledge of what it's like to think that way that many people don't have. So maybe that helps me to be a better person now. I don't know. It's still embarrassing. But back to those last 5 years of my life, since I was reading so much for classes, for sermons, for personal growth and edification, I had pretty much given up reading other sorts of things. Not to say I never did, but I rarely read fiction, military history, which I used to read quite a bit, pretty much focused on what we would call spiritual or ethical books or religious history. And while I'm not saying that's a waste, those years were certainly a bit unbalanced, let's say, in what I was reading. So now we return to my experiment with seated meditation with Zazen. Each morning I sat on my cushion, I stared at the wall, I sought to clear my mind and think of nothing with no desired end in sight. I did this because others, whose writings I found reasonable, said it was a good idea, said I would need to do this to fully understand Buddhism, and I wanted to give that a shot. I did want to understand. But of course, since you're not supposed to be seeking anything from this, it's hard to tell if it's worth the effort. I can't say that I truly understand Buddhism. You know, maybe I didn't do it long enough, I'm sure I didn't, or long enough in a day, I'm sure I didn't. But nonetheless, a few months ago, I came to one of those turning points in my life, and I said, you know what? I'm probably just wasting these 15 minutes every morning that I do this. And again, this is Doug. If you do it, it doesn't mean it's a waste for you. But for me, I decided, you know, if I do this every day, And if I did it for an hour a day, as most writers actually advocated, that's 365 hours a year staring at a wall doing nothing. And what else could I do with 365 hours in a year if I wasn't staring at a blank wall? And so I stopped. Now let me pause one more time, because I do not mean to demean meditation for anyone else. And if you go out of here thinking anything else, you haven't heard me clearly. I'm simply telling you how I arrive at my conclusions, because I do know many people benefit. And what works for me may not work for you, and vice versa. For instance, my daughter had stomach ailments for many, many years, and we went to the doctors and tried different medications, and nothing really helped. It wasn't crippling, but it was unpleasant. And she finally figured out on her own, by trying different foods, that if she stopped eating meat, her stomach didn't hurt anymore. Now, it would be absurd for her to say to everyone she encountered, if you stop eating meat, you won't have stomach aches. That worked for her, but that doesn't mean it's going to work that way for everyone else, because first of all, many people don't have stomach aches who happen to eat meat. And secondly, even if they did, the cause might be different. She found something that worked wonderfully for her. And that's a great metaphor for whatever it is you find in your life, spiritual or philosophical or ethical, that works for you. It isn't going to work for everyone else. We love to say, if everyone would just think this way, what a great world this would be. Well, everyone's brains aren't wired the same way. And so the deeply spiritual, mystical, perhaps magical approach to looking at life works great for some people and not at all for others. The hardcore, you might say, cold humanism of atheists and agnostics who still find joy in life but don't want anything even remotely mystical or magical, that may work for them, but it doesn't work for everyone, and other people need that. That's why this is such a great religion, Unitarian Universalism. I don't mind using the word religion. That's why it's so great, because it acknowledges that wide variety and so far has refused to start shoehorning people into one view or another. And it forces the mystical and the rational together, and you experience all these different things. And if you can just say, well, that one wasn't my cup of tea, but next week will be different, then we can all get along, because that is a small picture of what the entire world is like. So anyway, I did give up on the meditation, and I started to ask myself, now what? What am I going to do with those extra hours of every year? Life is really, when you stop to think about it, very short. It really is. Even if I live past 100, like my grandmother, who's still alive and kicking, almost 102 now, and doesn't show any signs of stopping anytime soon, even if I live that long, in the big scheme of things, that's insanely short. And while there's a whole lot of living to cram into 100 years of life, and it would be wise to choose what to do with that time that really gives that life the best meaning, the best joy, the best whatever you want to call it, whatever it is that's important to you. Think about that. What is it that I'm going to do with the rest of my life, and how am I going to decide to do that? Now, if you are seeking ultimate answers, if you are seeking to know God's will, seeking enlightenment, here's the real truth. There are thousands, if not millions, if not billions, of ultimate truths out there. And they are, for the most part, mutually exclusive. Consider, for instance, the ultimate truth of Christianity. If you decide, I'm going to find my ultimate truth there, well, where is there? Is it Catholicism? Is it Protestantism? Is it Eastern Orthodoxy? Consider the... this is the exhaustion catching up. Consider the bewildering array of requirements to receive eternal life. Must you be baptized or not? Is it by faith alone or faith plus good deeds that gets you into heaven? Must you take communion? Must you have last rites? Must you believe the Bible is the inerrant word of God, or is that optional? Must you believe in the Trinity, or is that optional? Is there a purgatory or not? Does Mary intercede for us or not? The list goes on and on. It can be quite intimidating and bewildering. And what's really amusing is if you ever get to talk to somebody who really knows very little about Christianity, as I did with a friend of mine named Chow, who was a Muslim who was going to Vanderbilt Divinity School with me, he thought all Christians followed the Pope. All of them. And I said, you don't know what Protestants are? He had no idea. All Christians do what the Pope says. In Islam, Shias and Sunnis kill each other as they argue over the proper succession of rulers after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Buddhists don't agree on the proper way to meditate. Do you stare at a wall, as I did? Or do you face the center of the room? Do you clear your mind, or do you chant? Do you count your breathing? Do you puzzle over a koan, those Buddhist riddles I talked about? Is reincarnation an essential belief or not? That's a hot topic nowadays. Do you have to believe that you will come back as something else after you die? Or is that optional? Zen master Brad Warner, and he is the fellow whose writings got me into this sitting and staring at a wall thing, and I love his writings. He says this about some of the most beloved Buddhist texts. We know full well that the sutras, like the Lotus Sutra, the Lakavatara Sutra, and even the Heart Sutra, are in some sense false, and that they claim to contain the words of the Buddha and his immediate disciples, but were composed hundreds of years after all these people were dead. Yet in spite of the lies contained within them, these sutras are essentially true, because they express something profoundly real. This is why religious people who insist on the supposed literal truth of their scriptures have got it all wrong. Scriptures don't need to be literally true to have deep meaning, the same way that novels and poems don't need to be literally true to affect us. It doesn't matter if the stuff recorded in the Bible literally happened or not, as long as the messages these stories intended to convey are true. This whole obsession with the literal truth of Scripture is ruining a lot of good that the people might be able to find in their religion. Now, at the beginning of the sermon, I promised you would get the final answer to life, the universe, and everything other than 42. And here it is, in all its profundity, Doug's answer to life, the universe, and everything, summed up in four simple words. Five, if you count a contraction as two words. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your time. You can picture Charlton Heston holding the tablets, and that's on the first one. Don't waste your time, and don't be a jerk. Plenty of people want to waste your time. They have an endless list of things that you should do, things you must do to conform, to be acceptable, to be holy. It is easy to get sucked into these systems that want to take your time away from you. Time is like money. You only have a certain amount that you get to spend, and then it's gone, assuming you're not getting more money flowing in. And our flow of money has stopped if you compare it to life. You have a limited amount, and when it's gone, it's gone. And everyone wants you to spend that money on something. You need to decide how best to spend it, because it is limited. A corollary to this whole idea can be found in the Wiccan Rede, R-E-D-E, which means counsel or advice. It goes like this. This is eight simple words. So you have my four words, you have eight simple words from the Wiccans. And it harm none, do what ye will. If you're not hurting somebody, do what you want. That sounds a little bit self-centered maybe, but you always have to preface it with don't harm anyone first. And there's a lot of way we can harm people. But if you can get past don't harm people part, do what you will. Enjoy life. When we are born, a clock begins ticking, a timer is running, our lives are limited in length. Each one of us must choose how we're going to spend that finite gift of life. Some religions will tragically tell you that this earthly life is just a test, just a testing ground to see where you're going to spend eternity, where your real life begins, where you will live forever. So what happens here can be miserable and unpleasant, and you can give everything to someone else, like the church, because you're going to get that reward after you die. Well, we can't actually prove that, but trust us. But meanwhile, give us everything, and then God will reward you afterwards. And so some of these unscrupulous religions, and they're not all unscrupulous, but the ones that are, will steal your time away, asking you to give everything you have, time, energy, and money, to achieve their ends so that you can get an eternal reward. Some will even urge their followers to kill themselves, as we have seen tragically over the last few years. Now, Douglas Adams wrote about the ultimate answer to the ultimate question. The running gag was that the answer was 42, but they hadn't quite figured out what the question was. And someone blurts out in exasperation, "Well, it's life, the universe, everything." And though it was meant as a joke, it actually provides a great conclusion to this sermon. Life. The answer, quite simply, is that we possess it. Life is what allows us to experience sensory input, taste, smell, sight, touch, and sound. And in turn, these senses allow us to have relationships, to experience emotions, joys, and sorrows. Life is the gift that the universe has given us. And if you call that the universe, the cosmos, God, the ground of all being, whatever you want to call it, whatever works for you, you have a great gift, this gift of life. And it brings us to part two of this ultimate question, the universe. The universe, all of everything, is vast beyond our imaginings. Whether you go to the vast reaches of space, or the bizarre world at the subatomic level, or a close examination of the ecosystem of your own backyard, there are literally an infinite number of things to explore and to do. Take advantage of your universe and enjoy it, explore it. How you do this is up to you. It's not up to me. It's not up to anyone else. They have no right to tell you how to enjoy this gift of life and this vast universe to explore. So you will have to find those ways, which brings us to the third part of the question. We have life, the universe, and finally, everything. No one knows everything, but a great many people claim to have it all figured out. Don't waste your time on them. If anyone says they've got the answer, run away, because that's going to be a one-sided conversation, because they have the answer, and they want to share it with you, so you can have the answer too. They're not willing to say, "Well, you might have a piece of the puzzle, and I might have a piece of the puzzle, and everyone else might have a piece, and what a great and glorious puzzle this will be when we've built it." No, no, the puzzle is already built. It's hanging on the wall back home for them, and they want you to come and enjoy their completed puzzle. And that's not a good way to use your limited time. Having been the person with the completed puzzle on the wall for many years, I can tell you, you don't want to talk to me when I want to show you my puzzle. It's a really dull conversation, and it's going to hurt. No, you find the people who are building the puzzle. Those are the people you want to hang with. People who say, "Come sit down at the table, and let's see if we can find some of these pieces that fit together and make a nice, larger picture." That's where the fun is. So here's my final parting thought. You will have to decide what is a good use of your time and what is a waste of your time. Many others will eagerly tell you how to spend your time. They're lining up wanting to tell you how to spend their time. Sometimes they're on TV telling you how to spend your time, and please send in a donation. I even heard a motivational speaker once tell a group of military people that he never reads a fiction book. He says it's a waste of time. All he wanted to do was read biographies and history. Now that sounds really tragic at first, but let me tell you a little about this guy. He had been severely wounded in combat. He had lost limbs. He was literally missing half of his body from warfare. And he walked around and he gave the most marvelous motivational speech imaginable. And he emphasized the importance of using your time wisely and living life to its fullest. And it was not a religious speech. But even after this, I wanted to go up and say, you're missing the, it's no fiction? What about Shakespeare? You've got to like fiction. And that was my reaction. You can't say fiction is a waste of time. You don't have the right to say that. Let me correct you. But you know what? It's not my place to tell him he's wrong. He was finding fulfillment in his life, and he had been through a lot worse than I had. And if he found joy and bliss in reading biographies and history, well, there's an infinite number of those out there to read, and we sadly know very little of history. And so I had no place to tell him but Shakespeare. If he didn't want to read fiction, he didn't need to read fiction. It worked for him. And I was the one who was missing the point. Now, admittedly, he was telling us fiction was a waste of time, and I don't agree with him on that. But my reaction should have been, well, that works for you, and you are finding joy and fulfillment in that. And that's cool. And I needed to just let it lie. So while I urge you not to let others waste your time, I also urge you to give others the space to find their path. When we share options and possibilities with others. We should not place demands of conformity on anyone. Just as the universe is infinite, so are our ways of enjoying it, our ways of experiencing it, of appreciating the gift of life. Live to the fullest every day. After 5 years of study, reading, seminary, and ministry, that's what I have for you. That's the big answer right there. Live life to its fullest. Don't waste your time. And I hope, in telling you this, that the last 5 years haven't been a waste of my time, nor the last 20 minutes of this sermon. Thanks for coming.